Hello world. This is Stephen Francis, and you're listening to the Humble and Honest Podcast. This is part three of my trilogy of best of conversations on the Humble and Honest Podcast. One of the reasons why I ever wanted to do this podcast was because despite all the podcasts that I listened to, there was not many podcasts that had black voices speaking about issues similar to mine. So it was a goal of mine to be sure that this podcast did just that. In this particular episode, this is the best of conversations from black leaders. Here we'll talk with people from the Ladies of Melanated Faith to pastors of churches of both multicultural and mostly black demographics. I encourage all of you guys not only to listen to this episode, but to share it with anybody who needs to understand a little bit better what the black Christian experience is for many of us living in America. Without further ado, enjoy it. My conversations with the many black voices that were on the Humble and Honest Podcast. But since it's three of us on the line right now, can we make a decision? Do we prefer to be called black or African American?
I think it's a personal preference for people. I prefer, and I'm fine with being called black. I say that because we're not a monolith, and there's people from different cultural backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. So you have black people who are in the Caribbean. You have black people who are, you know, obviously from the continent of Africa. And then you have black people. But you have black people are everywhere. That's my point. And so, like, to say African American, sometimes that just, that, like, that's referring to people here, but there's some people who would be like categorized as African American and they're not. They might be, you know, Afro-Latina from somewhere else, from a different country. So that's what I like to be called black, but it doesn't matter to me either way.
It doesn't matter to me either way. And I feel like historically I've been more black because I feel like that speaks to a specific experience, like my ancestors. I don't know what country that I'm from or like the tribe that I'm from because like a specific my ancestors were brought here against their will kind of thing. But I think just as I'm like growing and learning more about the diaspora and Christians across the globe, like I also see the benefits of saying like African American because I don't want to. I mean, I do think there are different experiences and that might be a conversation for a different day. But I also would think in terms of just like growth and what I would love to see among our people is more unity. And so I don't know. So I kind of go back and forth. I mean, I say black more often than not, but I can see the argument for African American.
Did you ever have a moment, whether it was Liberty before or after, where you realized just how different your ministry, your church upbringing was from the people around you? And how did that shape you once you got into that place, once you had that realization?
That is such a great question. I just want to say that's a phenomenal question. I'll say it came in three waves. The first wave was pretty early on because one of the things my parents wanted to do is they wanted to put me in the best possible education. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't have that opportunity growing up. And so they wanted to make sacrifices so that me and my siblings could. And so they put us in this independent fundamental Baptist private Christian school. And I say independent fundamental Baptist because that is drastically different from our church's denominational leaning. So our church mm-hmm. is non-denominational, but very Pentecostal, charismatic, very expressive, very fiery, very passionate. And the intersection of those things are everything that the IFB is not. So I grew up hearing Monday through Friday in the context of Bible classes or even history, sociology, whatever it may be, culture, that the way most people would associate black expression or brown expression of faith and life was wrong. Hmm. So there was this, obviously, you know, any sort of drums or clapping or movement that was considered to be flesh, that was considered to be culturally worldly. And so they would tell me that's wrong. And then I would go to church on Sunday and that's all we would do. and not all we would do, but you know, that's our cultural expression. And so I would sit back and I was like, wait a second, there's a difference here. And so it led to a lot of identity confusion because I'm drawing identity from my church experience, but you're telling me my church experience is wrong. It's heretical.
Yeah.
And so that was the first wave. And then when I went to Liberty, my first semester, there was the Obama election.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Go ahead.
You weren't there?
I was there.
Okay, you were there.
2008? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's interesting because the whole idea of the Obama election was, I was very, again, imbibing what the private Christian school said because I felt like white was right and they were getting more time with me than my church was. So mm-hmm. I just thought, okay, well, I guess we're wrong. I guess I'm wrong. I guess my parents are wrong. And that led to some of the bitterness and resentment within the church because I hated myself because y'all taught me to hate myself.
Yeah.
And so I sat back. I was like, well, I guess, you know, we're wrong. And so I was very conservative. I wasn't like an Obama fan by any stretch of the imagination and didn't vote for him.
Yeah.
But when I saw the reaction when he won, all the black students ran down to the middle of the Vines, the bottom of the Vine Center.
Oh my God. I was there too. You remember the dude that had the Obama t-shirt running around the Vine Center like he won the Olympics? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. We've never talked about this. So this is crazy.
Yeah.
And then everybody else was looking down. You know how all these white students looking down with arms crossed, basically mourning.
Yeah.
And I remember looking around because I was with the white students. I was looking around. I was like, y'all treating this like it's something different than what I thought. Like, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm kind of bummed out. But this is a historic moment and nobody was talking about the history. Nobody was talking about the significance. Everybody was kind of used that moment to get their vitriol off, get their hatred off.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. And I was like, yo, I'm in the wrong place because all my people, my kinfolk are down at the bottom and I'm up here with the people who are looking down on them. Like, look at them celebrating. Those simple people don't know what they voted for. They just voted for him because he was black. I'm like, why are y'all saying this around me? And so that's number two. And then wave number three would be right after Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson.
Oh, and talk then, to me about that.
Yeah, so I remember getting the notification that he was killed. And I was sitting across from my dad at the time. It was on a Saturday night. And I told him, I just kind of slumped down in my seat. And I just remember making an offhanded comment to him. I was like, yo, this is going to be big. And he was like, what? I was like, so I told him the story. And I remember he was like looking over his sermon notes or something. So he didn't really register with him. But I was like, nah, dad, this is going to be a big story. So I remember I just put some up on Facebook like, man, I hate to hear this happened. And, you know, unarmed black man was killed. And, you know, just praying for everybody involved. Well, I wake up the next morning and there's all these comments from people who are coming at me. And I'm like, I just said something super innocuous. Like, I didn't say, you know, riot.
You didn't come at the police. You didn't come at.
I really didn't. Yeah. I was just like, yo, I hate to hear this, man. I pray for a just world, you know, whatever. Praying for the family involved. And everybody had to get it off. And so I was like, yo, what is happening here? And then that began like the avalanche of the more I spoke, the more people resisted. And I said, oh, you liked me when I kept my mouth shut about justice. You liked me when I kept my mouth shut about my blackness. You liked me when I didn't identify with my skin color, with my people. And so that was a time where I saw, oh, we're different. And so those three waves kind of shaped me. The first wave kind of made me hate myself. The second wave made me kind of thrust me further into confusion. And the third wave was actually extremely clarifying for me.
You posted this, I believe, last week or maybe a couple weeks ago. One of the many challenges with parenting two black teenagers and pastoring a predominantly black church is fighting against the many layers of racism without instilling bitterness to the people I'm called to lead. And I fully resonate with that. And I want to lean into something else that you just said, because there are so many people that are hurting right now because of what somebody did not say, because of the negative comments that were said, especially this year. And I've had so many people that have ended friendships, ended relationships. I have people leaving churches saying, I don't want to be at this church anymore if you're not going to bring this up. I want to be somewhere else. I literally have members of my own family that were attending more multicultural churches that are now looking for churches that are predominantly black because they want to be with their people. And I want to know from you. First, I want to know how you feel about that. But also, I want to know how you feel about how do we best love people from a distance in the midst of the situation? Because people's true colors are coming out, whether it's this issue or the other things involved with politics. And for a lot of people, like you said, this is cancel culture. A lot of people, it's kind of like, if this is how you feel, I'm done with you. What do you say? How do we, from a healthy perspective, continue these relationships? Or should we, for our health, no longer have them?
So I'm not speaking out of hurt or even anger when I say this, but I do believe that relationships in general sometimes do have an expiration date. There's a book, man. There's a book that I love your audience to check out. It's by a guy named Henry Cloud, which is very notable. It's called Necessary Endings. And basically, he's talking about knowing when to end the business, you know, a project that you're working on. You got to know when it's past its point. I feel the same way about relationships. A lot of what he's saying is really transferable to relationships. There are some relationships that I think if you continue to force the relationship past its expiration date, I think you'll find yourself forcing something, and nothing force works. Nothing force feels, it just loses its organic authenticity. So I do think there are some relationships that should be ended. However, cancel culture ends everything right away without extending grace. I also believe that there are some people in your life, and this probably comes more of Holy Spirit discernment. There's also some relationships in your life that God intentionally puts that person in your life in order to teach you patience, in order to teach you how to extend grace. And so I don't think across the board you should cancel everybody, even the people that I've unfollowed. We'll still connect. I can't pull up your feed after watching Ahmaud Arbery get hunted down in the woods of Georgia. I can't pull up your feed and see on your feed that you went hunting that day. That's, for me, it's just, I can't do it, because there's something insensitive about that. You know what's going on in the culture, and you've decided to use your platform to just continue to keep casually being silent. So I do think that there are some, we've had to pastor some young ladies that have relationships that they had friendships of people that were white that did say insensitive things to them in the midst of like the class. I think this year around February, March, things just in terms of race tension, just they skyrocketed. Those are the times that you need to be like Job's friends. For a week, they sat and said nothing. Sometimes you just got to do that. And so sometimes when you have those insensitive comments constantly coming, the best thing for your health is to either disconnect or say, man, this ain't the season for our relationship to flourish right now. So I think we should probably pull back. But again, being wise, bro, I don't want to spew this in a hatred way. I do think that there are some relationships that need to teach you endurance and patience. However, I think there are some relationships that you do not have to endure the consistent ignorancy. Some things you have to pull back on. I know I've done it, and it's been extremely helpful for my health and my spiritual walk and me to be able to pastor people. It's been helpful for me to walk away from those relationships.
I want to ask this, and this is a deep question, but this is something that I want to talk about with you, because you did what you did, and it was so powerful. And there were other moments, the Charleston shooting and the people that forgave the shooter. Powerful. Last year, Botham Jean went on in the courtroom to forgive the woman that shot his brother. Powerful. And sometimes that evidence of forgiveness, as powerful as it is, can almost overshadow the need for justice in those situations. And the question that was asked to me was a difficult one, and I want to ask you to see what your answer would be. Are Black people too forgiving?
Oh, that is such a good and hard question. Here's what I'd say. First, I don't think forgiveness and truth are mutually exclusive. I think that's a false dichotomy that we present to ourselves and to others. That forgiveness, and I'll even say kindness for the sake of this conversation, and truth are mutually exclusive, and they have no relationship with each other. I actually think true forgiveness and true power-infused kindness require that the truth is told. I think any other version of truth telling or forgiveness, excuse me, in kindness is shallow. You know, I think there needs to be an acknowledgement of pain and hurt in order for there to be real forgiveness extended. I think that's something that's so special about the Black community, though. You look at our history and everything that Blacks in America have overcome historically. I mean, we survived on songs on freedom songs. Our worship is different in the Black church because of our history of pain and overcoming. I think about this place in the Gospels where Peter asks Jesus, hey, how many times should I forgive someone who sins against me? 7? And he offers that number to Jesus. He preemptively offers the number 7 to Jesus. And Jesus says, no, not 7, 70 times 7. Here's the deal about forgiveness and kindness. It's not necessarily fair. We can extend forgiveness to someone without them reciprocating and being in right relationship with us. We can extend kindness to other people without it being reciprocated. And as a matter of fact, we expose ourselves to further pain in a lot of circumstances. I don't think the Black community is too forgiving. I think it's the Black community is, in a sense, leading the way of Jesus in offering an example of what it means to take part and share in Christ's sufferings in a way that isn't fair. The forgiveness extended to me as a daughter of the Most High King wasn't fair, because if God's loving kindness and forgiveness to me was based on how I treated God, I'd be in a world of trouble. My goal and my hope and my prayer is that in talking about forgiveness and in talking about kindness, we are drawing people in to a power beyond ourselves, because you and I will get it wrong every single time. Like, we're imperfect people, but we're drawing from the power of a perfect and holy God. And so, yeah, in a way, I think there's going to be so many varying opinions about this. I don't think the Black community is too forgiving, because I think the Black community tells the truth. The Black community is fully awake and aware to systemic injustice and hurt and pain caused historically. And I think that forgiveness is coming from a place of deep power that longs for true change and reconciliation. So I think there's something really beautiful that we're being led in and witness and bearing witness to these examples of forgiveness.
I think a common critique that I have heard from different pastors or different Christians is the phrase Black Lives Matter. Essentially, they say, well, okay, Black Lives Matter. I've had to talk with people of why not the statement all lives matter, things like that. But also a lot of people say, I don't want to use the phrase Black Lives Matter because I don't approve of the organization Black Lives Matter. So therefore, I don't want to use the phrase. What's your rebuttal to that?
I am proud to say Black Lives Matter. And when I say Black Lives Matter, which I shouldn't have to say, we should know that all lives matter, meaning Black lives matter. But the reason we have to say that is because, let's be honest, on September 23rd, Breonna Taylor's life did not matter. And her name didn't even get mentioned. I just want to keep highlighting that, because that's pretty significant. I think the people that typically, at least the ones that I've talked to, that have completely tied my statement of saying Black Lives Matter to the organization, which, to be honest with you, I have core convictions as a believer and a follower of Jesus that I don't agree with everything that the organization stands for. I don't. However, I still can tie myself to the statement of Black Lives Matter because it stands true. And here's what's the problem. The people that typically have critiqued Black Lives Matter and tied us to the statement, at least in my perspective, have been white Christians that are comfortable with quoting, let's just say, a Jonathan Edwards, which was a slave-owning theologian. You don't tie yourself to his immoral practice, but you like his theology. And so the hypocrisy that comes out is very noticeable. I can tie myself to saying the statement Black Lives Matter without saying I agree with everything that's on the Black Lives Matter organization website. I'm comfortable saying, man, the two can actually be separated. And so for me, when I say Black Lives Matter, it does not mean I agree with everything the organization is saying. The same way some of these white evangelicals will quote a theologian that owned a slave and say, I don't agree with that practice. Wait, but you said his theology. So therefore you should agree with everything that he did. You don't, you know how to separate. And so therefore I should be extended the same grace to be able to accept, to separate the two. And I think, you know, just in terms of organizations and movements and the civil rights, you know, you had the church, Martin Luther King, and not just Martin Luther King, but a lot of these other organizations. SNCC would be an example of another organization, the NAACP, which is still existing today. These organizations, man, were ran by Christian Black leaders. And so you had a movement that was happening that was led by the church. Because we're not a unified church, at least in this country, because we're not a unified church, you've had to have organizations like Black Lives Matter organizations step up and do the work. I wholeheartedly agree with the work that they are doing. I do not agree with all of their sub points of what they believe. But guess what? That's what we got right now, because the church has not been unified. And the church doesn't even have a strong reputation to be able to stand on some of these issues. And when I say the church, I mean the American church. And so, again, just to answer your question, I'm totally comfortable in separating the two. And I feel no conviction saying Black Lives Matter. I do not feel like I have to tie to every belief of the organization because I set the stage.
Go a little bit further. And this one's going to be tough. To be honest with you, I'm curious to know what your answer is, because I'm trying the best to articulate this answer for myself. You have so many people that say, okay, Black Lives Matter. Okay, things need to change. Help me understand, what's the goal here that we're looking for in order to see change? What is it that we're fighting to accomplish? And I can understand why that's a difficult question to answer. Because when I think of Martin Luther King, they were fighting Jim Crow. They were fighting a very objective enemy, that I cannot be in the same restaurant or get treated with the same level of quality in an establishment because of the color of my skin. And that needs to change. Now we don't have, now it's a lot more subvert. So for you, what is it that you want people to know? This is a goal we should be having. This is something that we should be praying and being active in fighting for, to see change in this country.
That's such a profound question, because I think a lot of times it's easy for us to get wrapped up into situational. So we start looking at every situation and we just express anger, but we have no next steps. We have no, like you say, we have no goal that we are trying to obtain. What? How do we measure success? What would we say racially is a success? Like, how are we able to measure in terms of metrics success when it comes to racial tension? And here's what I would say. I think there's a couple of things. Number one, I think the goal spiritually is changed hearts. I think that's the goal. I'm still arguing with some of my brothers and sisters that white privilege exists. I shouldn't have to. Like, we should all be on the same page that you've. And I also want to say to your white listeners, your white audience, I certainly am not trying to beat you up. We're having a tough conversation because we should be having this tough conversation. And for so long, we've ignored it, which is anti the gospel. God saw sin. He dealt with it. He didn't sweep it under the rug. He didn't act like it wasn't there. He dealt with it. And it was painful. It was the cross. So I think these conversations are they're pointed to the fruit that the gospel can have. But I think a goal would be, of course, you gotta start to see hearts like really change. One of the things, you know, the civil rights was great in is changing laws. One of the things the church should continue to seek is not just change laws, but changed hearts. And so that means we gotta have relationships with people that don't look like us, don't vote like us, don't look at the video and see the same thing, but we actually have these, we have like tough conversations. I have a good friend, he's an older gentleman, he acts as a mentor. But there are times where he becomes the student. He's a pastor of a large evangelical, like probably 98% white church in Texas. Sometimes he flies out here, him and his wife, and my wife and I will sit down with him and we have hard conversations. But that's what it's gonna take. And what God is doing in those moments is he's changing hearts. And you have to do that relationship by relationship. So I think that's one of the primary goals. I think what the civil rights did try to continue to strive, and they made great. I mean, 1965 was a turning point in terms of the Voters Right Act, changing laws. We still are fighting to change laws. There's voter suppression, Stephen, that is happening right now in Florida. You have felons happen to pay fines, which, by the way, many of them are felons because of the 1994 crime bill. They were locked up for minor offenses. And so now they're felons and they weren't able to pay court fees and fines. And you're now asking them not to participate in democracy. That is voter suppression, which is why so many people are upset at Michael Bloomberg saying, man, I'm paying all their fines so that they can vote in this election. We're upset about that. Why are we upset about that? Do they not have a right? Voter ID. Voter ID can be a main voter suppression. There's 21 million people in this country that do not have government issue IDs. 21 million. And a large portion of them are minorities. And so I think we have to start to change. We have to elect officials from not just the presidency, but your local officials. You have to pay attention to what's going on in your state, what's going on in your neighborhood. You have to show up at the neighborhood meetings. Our precinct here has twice a month, they have meetings for the community. You have to show up and find out what's going on, and you have to elect people that will change laws. Stephen, we still have a major economic gap in wealth in this country. Man, I'm reading this book right now. I forget the name of it. My favorite book is always the last book I read or the current book I'm reading. So this is right now my favorite book. I don't know if you experienced that in your own life, but right now this is my favorite book. But in this book, I don't remember the author's name. It's an Indian woman, but she's talking about the economic wealth gap in our country. And she said that after the emancipation was signed, that Black people owned 0.5% of the entire wealth in the nation. Will you believe that 150 years later, we still only have bumped up another 0.5%? We still only own 1% of the nation's wealth. 1%.
Wow.
That is a major economic gap. But that didn't happen because Black people are lazy. That is a myth. That is not true. That is a very minute. White people, we can say, are lazy as well, right? But we don't paint all white people as lazy because it's not true. They're not all lazy. And all Black people aren't lazy either. There's an economic gap because there have been systemic issues that have pushed against Black people obtaining wealth. And so we'll allow the Oprahs, the Tyler Perrys, we'll allow them to get in so that we can point and say, hey, here's some Black people that made it, but you allowed them. Why aren't there more Black people in the middle class? Why aren't there more Black people in the upper class? That's because there has been barriers and hindrances. But I'll sum up this by saying that points to laws that need to be changed. And so I think the goal is, when we really see equality that is represented in our legal system, our policing, we have over policing, and I'm in Bed-Stuy. We talk about stop and frisk is huge in Bed-Stuy, but it wasn't as huge in Williamsburg. And so these are local level laws that I think we have to change the laws. We have to change our politicians. We have to change those who are representing us. And then ultimately we have to change hearts, because if you don't do that, the laws will flip back depending on who's in the White House. And you see what's happening with the White House right now.
So I want to ask this question, then I want to get all into the poetry, because you're truly gifted at it. And, you know, you're very passionate about the Black Lives Matter and treating one another as Christ has called us to treat one another, not in the cultural context of what fits. And sometimes when we're people like you, people like me that are in context where we are doing ministry in areas that's not as diverse or there's not as many people of color like us, sometimes we get the notion that we're the token Black person, that mm-hmm. we're the person that gets hired from a business or a ministry just so there's an appearance of diversity, but not always actually evidence of real diversity. I'm curious, have you dealt with this at all? And what is the result that you've come through with wrestling with the tension that sometimes exists in this?
Yeah, man. So I actually wrote a poem about this in the book, where I'm just kind of thinking about, what does it mean for me to want change, but not to be a token? Like to kind of play on those words. I do feel like if we want to see a difference made, if we want to impact communities that are not diverse, then the best way we do that is by showing up and being present. I think it kind of plays into the idea of tokenism when you're ignorant to the issues that are there. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like in a lot of spaces and a lot of times I'm encouraged to come and be present, but to be ignorant. You know what I'm saying? I think that's what encouraged tokenism. So the other day I had a meeting within our church staff, and they were like, hey, we're going to, you know, make all of our ministry people, you know, come to this mandatory training, race training, diversity training. But we're not going to demand it of our part-time people, because our part-time people have so many things going on. We can't make it mandatory for them to have, you know, working on the work hours. And an ignorant perspective would just be like, oh, yeah, that's cool. You know, whatever. But if you actually are opening your eyes and seeing things for what they are, the bulk of our ministry staff, actually all of our ministry staff, with the exception of me and two other people, are white people. The only diversity we have in the church is our part-time employees, our people who do our groundskeeping, our janitorial work. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's where we find out our most diversity. And so I just brought it up and I was like, why do you think that's a thing? Like, why do we only hire Black and Latino people to clean stuff, but we hire white people to do ministry stuff? Like, just calling a thing what it is and being able to see it for how broken it is, that's when I think you impact change. But when you're encouraged to be in an environment that doesn't allow you to speak out on what you see, that tells you to be present, to be a face, to be, you know what I'm saying, a picture of diversity, but not to actually add your voice, I think that's more tokenism. But when you're able to come to a place to actually give voice to some of the issues that are there that come from your unique perspective as a minority, that's where you impact things. And so I think for me, the way I've kind of landed it with it is, I'm going to be called all kind of names. That doesn't really give me a rub so much. What I desire for, what I ache for, is to see my community look as diverse as heaven's going to be. I don't currently see it. You know, I had a season when me and my wife first got married. We had a season where we were doing life in a semi-diverse context. And I say diverse as far as generationally. We were part of a community that had young folks, old folks, people who had like little kids, folks who were retired. Like, it was a generationally diverse. It was ethnically diverse. It was, you know what I'm saying, people from all different walks of life. I have not been in a context like that since then. And it's something that I miss, you know what I'm saying? And so when I go to places, it's my goal in my heart to be there fully. The things that I see from a unique Black perspective, but also just a follower of Jesus perspective, like, I feel like it's my responsibility to call things out when they are not the way I think heaven desires for them to be. So yeah, when that thing is said and you deal with the backlash that comes from that, like, whatever. I think that's counting the cost, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there is a cost and a cross to bear with that. If it looks like name calling, that's the least of my worries. But I do feel like I owe it to myself and my community and to the kingdom of heaven to be fully present within this skin and this culture, and call out the places where we see a lack of diversity, but not just like by representation, but also by opinion and in our hearts and our voices, you know?
Now, here's my big question for you as we wrap up, as we're about to wrap up, because I want to respect your time. I've heard it said from multiple people that if your church, in the midst of the racial tension, did not speak up, I've even heard them say if they tried to be in the middle about the issue, that people of color should leave the church. When you hear that statement, how do you feel?
It's a great question. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with that statement, not wholeheartedly, because everything is contextual once again. I think that people of color, that some people of color, let me say this, maybe need to be the change in those churches that they want to see by actually embracing those battles and fighting those battles with pastors, elders, and leaders by having dialogue and conversations. Mm-hmm. I think that if you are called to leave the church, then you leave the church and you leave peacefully among men and women. Now, let me backtrack before I even go there, though. Let me take a step back. If your church didn't address this stuff, is that problematic? 100%. I think that's problematic. And I think people of color will feel disrespected, will be disappointed, and will be hurt. But to not express that and say that you're hurt, to just leave right on the dime without sending an email or setting up a meeting is the epitome of not giving some of these churches the chance and the opportunity to change.
Okay.
Ignorance is a very real thing. Mm. Ignorance is real. And we have to ask ourselves, are we willing to have conversations even within the dynamics of people's ignorance? An example of this that I can give you, because I have such a multi-ethnic culture, I think I have a better understanding of this, because I got people that are pro-Trump and pro-Biden sitting in the same row. I got people that are pro-BLM and pro-All Lives Matter sitting in the same row. I got the right and the left in the same row. And so I feel like I face this maybe on a different scale than most people. My church, it's not like we're not all Republicans. We're not all Democrats, but we're all Christians. You know what I mean? And we have these different social issues that are very real that affect the kingdom, that affect mindsets. And so we have to go to the text to see what the Bible has to say about these things. But the way that we work out these issues is through dialogue, what we're doing right now. I had a young lady call my wife and I a couple months ago, and she was white. She was raised in a very affluent household, has amazing parents, went to a private school, one of the top private schools, one of the biggest K through 12 schools in the United States of America, ended up going to Cal, getting her master's, and is now an engineer in a massive firm. She does extremely well for herself, very educated, very articulate. And she called my wife and I, and she's like, hey, I'm really struggling with how Encounter is handling some of these social issues. And I said, well, why? I was like, because I think they're biblical. So let's talk about it. What are you struggling with? And she's like, you know, Chase, I just struggle with the black agenda sometimes. And I was like, okay. And instantly when she said that, I felt myself getting a little bit frustrated. I felt
frustrated just hearing you tell me
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I instantly started getting a bit frustrated. And she said, you know, Chase, like, for example, we talk about colleges. She's like, black people have their own colleges. She's like, there are black colleges, but we can't have a white college. And I was like, and instantly in that moment, do you know where I went to in my flesh? I was like, this person is not worth it. Demonic mindset. That's wrong.
Mm.
Conversations may not be worth it, but people are always worth it. Jesus showed us that on the cross. People are always worth it.
Yeah.
And so I have to ask myself the question, can I be like my Savior and put my pride aside? Let's go back to the revelation of Jesus. This idea where Jesus, who did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, so he lowered himself even to the point of a servant. In this moment, can I put my pride aside and have dialogue and not get offended, but have a conversation so that understanding can take place? By the grace of God, I did. I said, hey, do you know how black colleges historically got started? And she was like, well, no. I was like, well, let's do a little research together. And she found out that black colleges got started because black people couldn't freaking go to white colleges. it was a very easy thing for her to learn. I'm like, yo, that's why. And bro, you know what she did? She started crying.
Wow.
And she started researching history, started watching documentaries, and she is now one of the biggest advocates for people of color right now. Now, if I would have dismissed her, like a lot of people do, I'm like, you know what? You're so stupid. Like, I'm not having this conversation. You're an idiot. You're dumb. Waste of my time. Nope. You know what? You just need to leave the church. We don't want your kind of person here. Wait a minute. Can I be mature enough and godly enough to have a conversation? Mm-hmm. And for me, I don't want the black community or people of color leaving communities without doing everything that they can to bring change to those communities. Mm. And so you just rushing out and being like, cool, you're not going to talk about it, I'm out, before actually making a phone call and actually Matthew 18-ing it, which is going to the source if you have a problem and working that thing out. I don't know if that's the solution. And this is coming from someone who's had to have conversations with many pastors. Some pastors on my own, not on my staff, some pastors that are on my, not my staff, because I'm not the senior pastor of the church, but pastors that I'm pastoring alongside. Mm-hmm. I've had to Matthew 18 it on multiple occasions. Mm-hmm. For what? The sake of unity. And so for me, would I be an advocate to say, hey, if your pastor did not address this, leave the church? Not before I say, did you have a conversation? Did you send an email? Did you set up a meeting? Did you hop on Zoom? Did you actually work that out to say, hey, I am very hurt with the way that you've gone about this process? You want to know why? Because pastors have blind spots. I know I do. Now, is my blind spot racism? Nope. Is my blind spot equality? No. But for some white folks in America, this is how they've been raised. This is what's been taught in history. They literally don't know. And unless we do our best as people of color to educate them and inform them and be like, hey, this is how I'm feeling. This is what I'm experiencing at your church. Then you may have missed out on an opportunity for that person to grow and for that church to get better because you're in it. Mm. And so am I an advocate for people instantly leaving without having conversations? No, I'm not. I would say it's much harder to stay than it is to leave. Mm. And I'm not telling you to stay in a church where the pastor completely disregards you and says, you know what? We're not going that route. We're not going to be talking about those issues. This is my belief system. White privilege doesn't exist and yada, yada, yada. If he goes that direction, dude, you got more than right. Find a body where you can get plugged into and find a body where you can, you know, grow and get better. Yeah. But many pastors that I know in this season have been approached by people of color in their congregation, and it's made them better. Mm. It's made them more. My senior pastor has gotten better because he's a white man, Caucasian, and he has gotten better because staff members and congregants have gone to him and he's done things I never thought he would do. He's bringing up people on his platform to talk about things that they're experiencing in their day to day. Like, I've watched him get better because Matthew 18 is taking place, because people have spoken up and said, hey, this has been hurtful. Can we talk about this? This is what I'm experiencing. And so I think sometimes we're in a rush to just leave rather than taking the time to see reconciliation and growth take place, which is the heart of the Father. And I'll say this in conclusion. If Jesus gave up on me every time I didn't have my thought process right, I would have been gone a long time ago. And so I need to give people the same access that God gives me, because it's taken me years to get some of the lessons that God has been trying to teach me. Years. Mm. Like years for me to get some of these lessons that God has been just so graciously trying to teach me. And maybe this is an opportunity for me to grow. And so am I an advocate for people leaving instantaneously without dialogue? No, I would say I'm not. And I might be on the minority on that thought process. But my thought process, again, always goes back to the Bible. If you got an issue, go work it out. Mm-hmm. And if that issue can't be worked out, then make the decision to leave. Go find another house that suits you. But if you just left the church without having a conversation, I think that's whack. I think that's unbiblical. And we can work that out biblically.
It's a big deal nowadays for everything to be multi, for representation to be everywhere. You, as a pastor of a church that is dominantly one culture, do you believe that's okay in the culture that we're in to have that type of demographic? Because one can say, oh, if it's all right for you to have a church that's all Black, then why is it wrong for there just to be a church that's all white? But what do you say to the person that sees your situation and says that?
Yeah, this is a great question. It's a layered question. I'll say, you know, one of my burdens as a pastor is to help our congregation and to help Christian people in America think in non-binary ways. So one of the ways that we tend to see this is a very black and white thing. It's either yes or no, it's right or wrong. And we deny the layers and dimensions of different conversations, right? Mm-hmm. Just because two things exist doesn't mean they got there the same way. And so the age-old response is the response you gave. It's this idea that, oh, well, if it's either yes for both or no for both, it's either right for both or wrong for both. And the layer is, take a step back. Why are there all Black churches? Why are there all white churches? just because we got to the same destination doesn't mean we went to the same journey.
Interesting. So
the Black church exists not because it wanted to exist as a Black church. The Black church exists because it was rejected. People, Black people were rejected by the white church. You take, for example, Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, the founders of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. What happened? They knelt in the wrong section in the Methodist church. They prayed. They were praying in the wrong section. And they were asked to leave. They said, can you wait till we finish praying? And they said, no, you have to get up now. And they were thrown out of the church. And then they said, well, I guess we're going to start our own church. Research the inception of the Church of God in Christ and the ways in which it intersects with the Assemblies of God. You know, research some of these National Baptist conventions and the way they intersect with white denominations. We weren't allowed to be ordained. We weren't allowed to preach. We weren't allowed to sit in the same section. We were allowed to be saved. We were allowed to be in attendance, but we were not allowed to flourish. So we went to a place that allowed us to flourish fully. That's why the Black church exists. So do you think that a place that allows Black people to flourish fully is the same as a place that excludes a group of people and says, you cannot come in and sit where we sit and exist where we exist? And now it's not explicit. Now it's just a glass ceiling. It's an invisible barrier. You can only reach a certain level. You can only get to a certain... We'll transition, but we need to I don't know. I don't know if we can transition to a Black pastor. These are not speculations. This is exactly what has happened. These are things that are happening even presently now in this year. Yes. So as we think about that, you know, the question has to be a little bit more nuanced for us to ask now in 2020. And it has to be a question of, are we doing everything possible to dismantle the force that caused the division? Mm-hmm. That force has always been, that stronghold has always been white supremacy and white normativity. And are we humble enough to learn from non-white voices? And are we humble enough? And there's some people who are. If you take, for example, one of our family's personal friends, Bishop Gary McIntosh.
Yeah.
Bishop Gary McIntosh transitioned his ministry to a young Black man. That was a risky decision. Mm-hmm. That was a decision that cost him something, but it's yet and still something he was willing to do. And now the benefits, you see them. Peter Schizzero up in New York, New Life Christian Fellowship, transitioned his ministry over to Rich Velotis, who is a Latino pastor. He made that choice. He made that decision. And now he's reaping the benefits of it. Yes. So we have to ask the question, are we willing enough to listen to people of color and dismantle white supremacy? And that will, regardless of where we worship and how we worship, will create a healthier church, a better church, and a more united church. That's what the goal is. Not that we just worship together and say we're all multi-ethnic churches, but the goal should be that we're healthy and we're not allowing this invisible stronghold to create divisions where none should be.
Well, what's your thoughts on the NFL season, especially with some of the turnarounds that we've kind of seen in regards to just the Kaepernick situation? Obviously, Colin Kaepernick is not playing, but we've seen a lot more team support in regards to the kneeling and the protests. And you have some episodes about racial reconciliation as well. Give us a quick summary of what you're feeling and thinking in regards to the NFL right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a huge NFL fan, obviously. I used to work for the NFL, or I guess work for the teams that in the NFL, and love the sport, grew up playing it. The season's been crazy. You've seen a lot of injuries happen. Kind of pivoting and looking at kind of how the NFL has kind of addressed some of the, you know, racial injustice in America. I never thought I'd see the day where Roger Goodell would say, I apologize and I was wrong. I never thought I'd see that day. I was very shocked. I know a lot of guys that still play, some coaches, people that work for the NFL Players Association, all feel like, wow, like we never thought we'd see that. Now, that's great, but Colin Kaepernick, You know, I grew up in the Bay Area. I was a 49er fan. I played against Colin Kaepernick in college. We were in the same conference. He's a good guy. He's a stand-up human being. And, you know, he's clearly better than some of the guys on the bottom of these roster. And so a lot of these rosters. And so, of course, he deserves a job. How I feel about the way they've addressed that, I feel like it's a little bit too little too late, quite honestly, in regards to Colin, because I'm glad while they did admit some of these things, Colin doesn't have a job and he's a good enough football player to have one. And I know that there's a media stigma, and some of this happened with Tim Tebow when he was just like, the media got so large where it was just like, if we get him, he's going to destroy, I've been in NFL locker rooms, you know, like if you have 50 additional news trucks outside your facility, it just changes the dynamic of a practice. Some of it might be that, but I think a lot of it has to do with just the fact that, man, like, they don't want to get political in all of this, and that's a little bit frustrating for someone who's for me. And so I think one, Colin deserves a job. The other thing is, I wonder how genuine the NFL's apology is, in the sense of, I mean, the NFL basically does whatever it can to make money. If the NFL doesn't care about black or white, it will be as racist or as inclusive as it has to be, as long as they make money. That's just the fact of the matter. The NFL, I truly don't think the NFL is innately like racist against Colin Kaepernick. I just believe they made a large, horrifying business decision. I think they make business decisions. I wonder if Goodell's apology was also a business decision, given the turning tides in America with George Floyd and all of this. So I have lots of varying thoughts. I know that the conversation is good, that more conversation is better. And I just don't think we're going to see Colin back in the NFL, unfortunately.
I agree.
But I think Colin, to some degree, probably knew that. I think maybe he understood that maybe I'm the sacrificial lamb in this, and he's going to be the first one to kind of get hit by the bus, and others might be able to speak their minds more freely and to be able to stay on a team. And so, you know what's crazy is it's only been 4 years, and look how quickly the tide has turned. So I don't know what the future holds. I remain frustrated, but I also know that what Colin did has permanently changed the NFL.
And there you have it. Thank you to all the incredible leaders and influencers that were on this show. I put a link in the description for all of the episodes that you heard, and even a couple more in case you might be interested in hearing some different perspectives on these issues as well. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Join me again next week on the season finale of the Humble and Honest Podcast.